Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 21st of January. The first hour of our program today, we're going to be talking about Haiti. We hope to establish communication with people who are on the ground in Port-au-Prince. Chip Duncan sent us an email over the weekend saying that he was going to be heading to Haiti with Relief International and that he would try to establish contact with us during the week. We've been able to get emails from him, and we had a phone connection for a little while that wasn't very good. So we're trying to connect with him right now, along with Dr. Hernando Garzon, who is a Kaiser Permanente emergency physician in Sacramento, California, and is a team leader for Relief International in Haiti. Chip and Dr. Garzon are together, so we'll get an on-the-ground report of how the aid distribution is going, whether or not those supplies and the doctors are getting from the airport to the areas in need, those areas that have not been touched yet. How many people? We were hearing statistics last night of an enormous number of people who are dying who could be saved if there were enough medical attention. So we'll look at all of that. Dr. Marvin Birnbaum will also be joining us, Emeritus Professor of Medicine and Physiology with the University of Wisconsin, Vice President for Humanitarian Affairs for the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine, and we'll look at disaster relief throughout the country. He's been writing extensively about other disaster relief. What is a model, if there is one, for relief in Haiti? How long will it take in order to improve the lives of the people who are there? There's so much to talk about this hour. We'll be welcoming your phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And if you'd like to send an email, that address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. In a recent email, Chip said that Dr. Kate Wolf, who lives in Haiti but was in Miami at the time of the earthquake, is also working with the Relief International group. And some of you in Milwaukee may know about her because she worked at St. Joseph Hospital here in Milwaukee. So there are Milwaukee connections, of course, in Haiti, and many Wisconsin connections as well. We're going to be trying to establish connection. You'll understand that the phone conversation is sporadic from Haiti, so we will move them onto the air as soon as we are able to talk to them. We're just having a hard time with that connection. But I know that there are many of you, and we've spent time last week talking with people who have done humanitarian work in Haiti for a long time, and many of you, I know, have been sending aid and money, and we'd like to hear from you during the course of this hour as well. I think we've established connection. Chip, hello.
Hello, this is Dr. Garzon, Relief International.
Hello, Dr. Garzon. So nice to hear from you. So what have you encountered in Haiti? Is it chaos, as you predicted it would be before you left?
Yes, it's been total chaos. It's been very difficult to get anything accomplished. We finally got a clinic up and running yesterday, and we saw 70 people in about 4 hours. About 60% of them still had major trauma from the earthquake that had not been addressed or treated.
Mm-hmm. And what were you treating them for, Dr. Garzon?
I'm sorry?
What were you treating patients for? What were you seeing? The injuries?
They were, thigh bone fractures, amputated fingers, polytrauma with loss of skin tissue that needs plastic surgery repair. We saw a baby with a head injury that was paralyzed on half his body. Some very major injuries.
Tell me about the relief that is coming in. Are there more and more doctors, Dr. Garzon, who are arriving in Haiti? Are they stuck at the airport? Do we need a whole lot more medical help there?
I don't think we need a whole lot more medical help. I do think you're right. There are a lot of volunteers. The problem is getting the logistics of the thing so it's finally operating smoothly. Communications has been poor. The ability to get around has been poor. The ability to refer people who need higher level of care to other places is poor. But now we finally are standing up the field hospitals with the surgical capability. The U.S. Comfort is here. Just in the last 24 hours, they've taken about 500 patients. So things are starting to improve.
Mm-hmm. How many doctors do you have working with you, Dr. Garzon? Are you by yourself?
No, our Relief International team is now up to 16 or 17 people. We have paramedic, firefighter, and then logistical support staff as well.
Uh-huh. We were hearing reports last night that there are thousands of people dying every day in Haiti from gangrene, from diseases that could be cured if they had medical help. Are you getting that sense?
Absolutely. I don't know if the number is thousands, but that's definitely a problem. These people that in our country would have had treatment within minutes or hours are here day six, day seven, where it's amazing that these people have survived this long. And there are definitely people dying of preventable medical illnesses and trauma.
What can we do about that?
I think support your favorite relief agency, and I think we're ironing out the logistics is up to the people who are already here on the field and giving them the resources they need. So relief organizations, the more funding they have available, the more resources they can use to solve the problem.
There obviously is a desire to move people out of Haiti. A number of people have wanted to adopt children. They've seen pictures of orphanages. Can you, and we're also talking about opening Guantanamo so that a number of people from Haiti can receive services in Guantanamo. From what you've seen on the ground, do you think that that will be necessary, that people are going to have to leave the country to get treatment and to get another life?
To get treatment for acute injuries, absolutely. I think that the healthcare resources here are not sufficient to deal with the trauma, especially even with the seven surgical field hospitals we have. And a lot of people have already left, and hopefully more will go for definitive care. I think it becomes a totally different social question about people leaving here to find a different life. I think the adoption process is terrific. I think we there's all sorts of cultural issues around removing people and children from where they're born to take them to a different culture. So I'm sure many people can stay here, return here, and rebuild a Haiti and keep their cultural identity and really not have to leave. But it's going to be a long process to recover from this event, for sure.
Yeah. You said you saw 70 people yesterday. That's a huge number of people. How many people would you normally see at Kaiser Permanente in Sacramento, California? Nowhere near 70, I'm sure.
No, in a 24-hour shift, and we have one of the busier emergency departments, we see about 140 people in a day. So to see 70 is quite busy, especially to do it in a 4 or 5 hour period.
Yes. Have you had to perform surgeries there, Dr. Garzon?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the entire question.
Have you performed surgeries?
Well, we do not have anesthesia or an operating suite, and we're a team of emergency physicians. So we have done some fairly extensive wound repair and debridement and the kinds of things that we would normally do in an emergency department back in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been advanced medical care that you would not normally find access to here in Haiti.
When you talk about the trauma that you see people experiencing, I'm sure there's much psychological trauma as well. What is the trauma they're experiencing 8 days after the earthquake?
You know, there's no question that even every single individual who wasn't even physically injured has been emotionally affected by this. And we saw a gentleman in the street, one of our team members asked him if he had any medical concerns from what he experienced, and what he said was psychological. And there is absolutely a need for that. As a matter of fact, I think the next team members we'll have coming in will be mental health workers trained in critical incident stress.
From what we've seen, the images in Haiti, I am so struck by this kindness from the Haitian people. I can't imagine being as patient as many of them have been for over a week now. Their kindness, their gratitude for your help.
They're very resilient people, and I think they live a very hard life at baseline. I think most of us who are fortunate to live in the U.S. really have no comprehension of the kinds of suffering people endure in these environments, even in their regular life. And they've been through hurricanes before, and they have a different mindset. You're right, there is a lot of patience here.
Yes, it's quite extraordinary to witness this. And what about you, Dr. Garzón, and the other people who are on the ground helping? How are you emotionally affected by all of this?
It's very moving for me, and I've done this work a lot, so I'm more comfortable and used to these environments than most, and I do have a sense of what to expect. And even with that, it is really is very humbling and very emotionally challenging to see what is going on here.
Yes.
But I think it is for all of us. And one of the things we do as a team, we debrief every day, and we're here to support each other because it really has to happen, because I think you can't be in an environment like this and not be affected by it.
No, I'm sure you can't. Is Chip with you, Dr. Garzón?
Yes.
Yes. Could I
standing right here with me.
All right. We'll let you return to your vital work, and if we could speak with Chip for a few minutes, that would be great.
Okay, terrific. Thank you.
Carry on, sir. No, thank you. Thank you for your time. Dr. Hernando Garzón, Kaiser Permanente emergency physician in Sacramento, who saw 70 patients yesterday and is continuing his work there now. Chip, hello.
Hello. How are you?
Hi. I'm all right. How are you?
Well, it's a little crazy down here, as you've heard the news reports, so you know. I mean, it's... The great thing is the Relief International team is doing a great job. The clinic is up and running. Before I left, the reports on the aid community not getting here and where's the medical support and all of that is just mind-blowing how difficult it is to move in a place where the infrastructure was bad to begin with and then completely destroyed. So I'm happy to say the RI team is up and running and doing great work.
We're hearing that there may be as many as 3 million people, Chip, who have no homes. What will they do?
Well, what will they do is we're already seeing an exodus here. That local doctor from Milwaukee, who you should be aware of, Katie Wolf, who used to work at St. Joseph, she's on the medical team here. We found her. She lives in Haiti. We found her in Miami. She was there during the quake and couldn't get home, so she's part of the RI medical team here. And her observations as someone who's lived in Haiti for a long time is that roughly a third of the population has either left or is leaving, which means they're going back to their local, some much bigger cities like Jacmel or Gonaïve, but many are just going back to their smaller villages, which long-term, Haiti's had a huge unemployment problem for the last, many, many years, and long-term, it's going to be just as difficult for them back home. There's no jobs. So the city itself, though, is unbelievably congested with traffic. Communications are so bad. We were trying to phone in, see if our cell phones would work for more than an hour just to talk with you, so we finally resorted to the sat phone. But it'll settle down. All of these situations do, and I like to focus on hope, and we're seeing a lot of hope, not just the work the doctors are doing and the evacuation process, but also things that where the city is returning to normal life. The street markets are open. People are selling produce and water and sodas on the street. So a lot of just the day-to-day life things, if you weren't impacted by the earthquake, you're almost back to normal.
Mm-hmm. Where are people sleeping, Chip? Are they still outside under the stars at night?
Well, there's a lot of people that have now started congregating in the open parts of town, as many as large tent cities, especially around the presidential palace area where there's a lot of open space. So, yes, people are congregating. We've got emergency tent shipments coming in with the hope that we can get people located near their homes and try and avoid the big IDP camps that you see in different parts of the world. But right now, the big issue, people because they're afraid of the quakes. We had a 6.1 yesterday morning, and even our medical team was in a small guest house, and we all had to evacuate.
Oh.
So people are still very unnerved. So part of it is just the desire to sleep outside, not under structure. And then the other part is that if you lost your home, you're congregating.
Right. And when you said that markets were reopening, they still have goods? There's food somewhere?
Well, yeah, that's, I mean, you know, for people who've been in a lot of developing world countries, you know, you see a lot of street markets and, you know, people will just be selling water or soda or juice, or somebody else might be selling additives or produce. Those markets, when you're driving through large sections of town, are open. The little street vendors are operational. So how they're getting their produce or their eggs or their chicken or meat, I don't know. I was very encouraged to see that. So I don't know that it's way too early to know what the long-term problems will be, but I'm guessing that food will not be among them.
Right. You've been to other disasters, following disasters in other parts of the world, Chip. When you look at what you're seeing right now in Haiti, how do you compare it? Do you see it as a horrendous disaster? Do you see what's happening now? Can you hear me now?
Oh, yeah, now I can
Okay.
hear.
When you see what's happening in Haiti now and you compare it with other parts of the world where you've been with Relief International, do you see this as one of the biggest horrors that you've ever seen?
I guess I'd have to put that into a context, because the big challenge here is that the earthquake epicenter was in an area of really high population density. Pakistan, by contrast, it was much more spread out in a mountainous area. So you saw, when I was in Pakistan, I did not see any single structure left standing. Here, I would say it's more random. You might see two houses down and then four or five still standing. And so the earthquake impacted this area very differently. It's much more concentrated population density. So it also has a harbor and an airstrip. And the Pakistan earthquake happened in such a remote area that you could only really use helicopters to get things in initially. So I'm not a disaster specialist by any means, but I think I would have to say the living conditions in Haiti were pretty bad before. So for a lot of people, it's their normal lives are just continuing as they were. Mm-hmm. Certainly, the injuries are devastating, and yeah, the death is a devastating thing to see.
Oh, I imagine it must be so devastating, Chip. Will you be able to transmit pictures of what you're seeing to us at some point?
Yeah, I actually managed to get 9 photos up on Facebook. And I'm guessing that link is pretty, I mean, you just go to the Duncan Facebook. I don't have any place special to send you, but I managed to get some photos up. I got the same photos out to Relief International. So I'm guessing by tonight or tomorrow, I'll have, you know, a lot more ability to upload photos. And then hopefully next week I'll be back and, take it from there.
All right. And we'll talk then. Chip, thank you very much. Thanks for arranging the interview with the doctor. Yes.
My hat's off to the RI team. They're doing great work.
Yeah, they sure are. Many are. Thank you, Chip. Chip Duncan joining us by phone from Port-au-Prince, where he's traveling with Relief International. Also joining us by phone, Dr. Hernando Garzon, who's an emergency physician in Sacramento, California at Kaiser Permanente and is the team leader for Relief International, which is based in Haiti. You heard him say earlier they just set up a medical center yesterday and saw 70 people yesterday, and that was in 4 to 5 hours. Imagine the number of people they'll be seeing today. I didn't want to risk phone calls because it was hard enough for everybody to hear, for Chip and Dr. Garzon to hear us. So we will be taking phone calls the next portion of our program. Joining us in just a moment, Dr. Marvin Birnbaum, Emeritus Professor of Medicine and Physiology at UW-Madison and Vice President for Humanitarian Affairs for the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine. Our number is 800-486-8655. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Marvin Birnbaum joins us now. He is the former president of the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine, and he is, he's done a whole lot of work. He is the medical director of the City of Madison Fire Department Emergency Medical Services System, the paramedic training program, medical director of emergency medical services for the Division of Intercollegiate Athletics at the University of Wisconsin, and he is a member of the executive committee for the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is the number. Dr. Birnbaum, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity.
From what you've been able to see, do you think that the emergency response in Haiti is A, sufficient, and B, well-coordinated?
No. I think that's a short answer, and I think the two questions you asked are important. The coordination is the, I think, the principal issue here, as it has been in most disasters, and I think that's a major problem in all disasters. I don't think this is particularly unique, however.
And the coordination is difficult because there isn't much of a functioning government in Haiti?
I think the coordination is difficult, number one, because there was no good infrastructure in Haiti that could essentially be in charge of the coordination and provide coordination and control of what was happening. And I think, therefore, there actually is competition. We know of at least four organizations that are attempting to provide the coordination, and they're running in parallel, and that makes for real problems and duplication and inefficiencies, et cetera.
So somebody needs to take charge.
Somebody needs to say, I'm in charge. That's correct. And it's difficult because there is a certain amount of competition, and there is a certain amount of political competition as well.
Competition what, between the U.S. military and the United Nations, or who are we talking about?
I think there's competition between many of the responders. I think they all go and do what they do because of their desire to help, but it gets real problematic when things are not coordinated and responses are not in tune with the needs.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people in their good wishes and their goodwill want to provide what's needed, that we all want to help, and I think stuff comes and people come, and therefore they don't necessarily get to the places where they're needed. They often don't arrive with the ability to move themselves and their materials and people to where they are needed, and they often come with materials that are not needed. So one of the real problems, I think, is in providing assessment of needs, real assessment of needs, and then the responses need to be directed at needs, and priorities need to be selected.
Mm-hmm. So who should be in charge?
Well, I think the national government ideally has to be in charge, and I think if you're going to do one thing around the world that would improve disaster coordination and control, it would be training the national governments to be in charge. The Ministry of Health in Haiti should be the responsible agency for doing coordination and control. They can pass that up. They could pass that up to the Pan American Health Organization if they wished. And I from what I hear, that has not happened. And so the regional office of the World Health Organization is really the group in charge of what's called the health cluster, the country health cluster, or the regional health cluster. And the cluster movement is an interesting outcome of what happened following the tsunami.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems as though if they're going to take charge, they need to do it yesterday, and if they're going to pass it along, it has to happen immediately. People are dying.
Right. There has to be a comprehensive disaster response plan for the country. There has to be a comprehensive disaster response plan for the region, and there has to be a comprehensive response plan for the global response plan. And there have been attempts to do this, but so far it has not been successful.
Mm-hmm. And how do you go about doing that? Do you just send people to communities all over Haiti? How do you assess what needs to be done?
Let me go back a minute to perhaps help with this discussion. One of the things that became very, very apparent for the first time following the earthquake and tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004 is it became very apparent that coordination and control were lacking, and that there was much duplication, and that there were unnecessary things being done, and, for example, psychotherapy being provided and drugs being provided to people that were still in the grieving process, et cetera. What happened following this awful kind of circumstance is that the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs initiated what is called the Humanitarian Reform Movement. And what the Humanitarian Reform Movement is attempting to do, and I think it's working to a certain extent in Haiti, is the Reform Movement assigned initially 9 what they call clusters, and then now it's been expanded to 11. The clusters went down, basically down the functions of a society that's been impacted. And essentially, the clusters' objective is to bring all the people, all of the stakeholders to the table to provide coordination in that particular aspect of the affected society. There is one health cluster, and that's the global health cluster. And the World Health Organization appointed the Health Actions in Crisis, its Health Actions in Crisis Department, as the lead agency for health coordination. The Global Health Cluster, and I'm privileged to sit with that and to participate with that, has brought most of the major players in health to the table, meeting at least biannually, doing a lot of work, primarily through volunteer efforts, because they're not well supported, in an effort to establish a global health cluster and establish policies and strategies, et cetera. And then they're attempting to develop country clusters, health clusters. The country cluster for Haiti is now in operation, and they are gradually moving this together with the Pan American Health Organization being the lead agency for the health cluster. And they are now meeting daily and have participation of more than 40 organizations and 75 individuals. So they are attempting to get the people to the table to get some coordination between the various agencies that have responded.
Mm.
This is the first time, basically, that this has been operational. And we're going to have to see how this comes out. But there's no surprise in terms of the delays, or no surprise in terms of the what's getting in and what's not getting in. This has been done over and over and over again. And I think we're finally beginning to learn a little bit about what can be done and what's realistic and what's not realistic.
So what do you think is realistic?
I think realistic is that we have to... I think the first issue in all of this is the... performance of really good assessments, and from these assessments to determine the needs, and then from the needs determine plans and implement interventions that can meet these needs. So I think one of the things that has to happen at the cluster is that the people have to share their needs, their perceived needs. What happened in other major events, such as the tsunami or the earthquake in Pakistan, or the earthquake, we don't know much about the earthquake in China yet, is that that many of the organizations came in and did their own needs assessment and then didn't share them.
I see.
And so if you don't share them, then the other actors don't know what's going on, and they try to do the same thing. They detect the same needs and try to meet the same needs, and then it becomes a competitive issue. So it's all not pretty. I think what we really learned so far from this is that the responses have to come regionally, not globally. If a country can't deal with the event and the damage and the changes in its functional state by itself, and it asks for help, I think that ought to come from the region, not from the world.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the Israeli team, which is doing wonderful work in Haiti at this point, why did they have to come halfway around the world when we're sitting an hour away, and the United States is sitting an hour away, and... the Dominican Republic is just across the border, et cetera. And that's a big issue. Where should the response come from? Does it have to come globally, or is the global response a political issue rather than how are we going to do this best?
And yet we've seen from those forces, and certainly from Turkish forces who are expert for whatever reason in getting people out of the rubble, they've saved lives pretty dramatically.
Yes, they have. But the search and rescue teams, the international search and rescue teams, generally arrive too late to salvage very many people. And what the media does is they hype up the one or two people that are rescued after 72 hours or 4 days, 5 days. And they're very effective generally in retrieving the dead. but they get there too late. And if it was a regional response, can we, in fact, enhance and speed it up, giving the search and rescue teams priority to get there?
Mm-hmm.
And but if you imagine, just using the Israelis as an example, because I was in Israel when this happened, the Israelis first sent in a needs assessment team. And then they sent the material forward, but that was days. And so they're performing a really important function in one of the field hospitals. But, you know, the traumatic injuries will make their way either within the next several days. And if they're not controlled, there's going to certainly be more deaths because people can't get medical care. But the question is how the priorities are set. There's another big issue is the relative safety of the workers that come, and I think people hesitate to do that, and there's not enough attention to safety, and I think that's why you've seen the U.S. military there in an effort to provide safety for the workers. So I think the real issue is where should the help come from, and where is the plan that's going to mobilize this next time? If there's a major earthquake in Mexico City tomorrow, what's the regional response going to be? And I don't know that we have a regional response plan.
Let's welcome phone calls. Dr. Marvin Birnbaum is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. Emeritus Professor of Medicine and Physiology at UW-Madison, Vice President for Humanitarian Affairs for the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine. Jeff is our first caller from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning, and good for you, Wisconsin Public Radio, for getting the right people on the radio on this. Dr. Birnbaum is certainly the right person to have here. I just, a couple of comments. I'm looking at, on my computer, photos sent to me by a former coworker at Catholic Relief Services. His son was on one of the ships that took a look at the port. I'm looking at the containerized port in Port-au-Prince right now, and it is a shambles. In order to get significant relief supplies into a situation like this, they really have to. They come in by sea. There are the few airdrops and whatnot, but any substantial amount of goods comes in by vessel. And I'm looking right now at the containers that are in the port. Between the containers and the trucks that are supposed to get them out, there is a 4-foot collapsed bit of pavement just flooded over. The trucks can't even get to them. And so this is just in response to a lot of people I heard on Talk of the Nation, others on the radio yesterday about why aren't things moving, what is going on, why is it so slow. This is one of the most complex logistical operations I've ever seen, and I've been in the business now for 25 years. It is one of the most complex. The other comment I just want to make is that in commenting on Dr. Birnbaum's critical question, where should help come from? We can't forget that there are a lot of people on the ground in Haiti at the time this struck. CARE International, I'm doing some work for them right now, they had 133 staff in Haiti at the time this happened. CRS had people on the ground and got people in literally the morning or the day after this earthquake. Some of their emergency team, which is normally based in Nairobi, managed to get there within a day or two. So things are happening. It is extremely complex, but I think we should all realize that there is a response on the ground that started. World Food Program had 120 tons of food in the warehouse that started getting distributed within a couple of days. So things happen right off the mark. It's absolutely not enough, but we can't lose all hope. I think we have to look optimistically at what is going on in one of the most difficult situations, at least that I've seen.
And what is the work that you do, Jeff?
I'm sorry?
What is the work that you do?
I used to be the coordinator of the disaster response team at Catholic Relief Services. I'm a consultant now, and I work on assessments, as Dr. Birnbaum was alluding to, mainly with World Food Program, but I also am working a lot with CARE International and other NGOs that do this sort of work.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Birnbaum.
Yeah, I think I don't mean to be negative, Jeff. I think that there's a lot of good stuff going on, and I think there's always a lot of good stuff going on. The primary issue, though, for me is still coordination, and with the knowledge of the logistical constraints, I think Haiti was very well served by many NGOs before the event occurred. But there still is a this overarching lack of coordination that I'm most concerned about. And that has to be planned. That can't happen spontaneously. That has to be the modus operandi, if you will, of the whole humanitarian community. And we just have to start talking with one another. I think that's happening. I think that gradually is occurring as I observe what's going on in the global health cluster, where we initially couldn't even talk and were very threatened by each other. It's now very different. It's now very open, and people really beginning to move to begin to learn from what we have learned. I think what one of the big issues for us ongoing, and I think it was best stated in the Phuket meeting following the tsunami, and the director then of the Health Actions and Crisis Department of the UN says, why have we not learned, or why do we not learn from what we have learned? And I think we don't go in and do adequate evaluation so we really can figure out what went wrong in process and then try to fix it. I think we've been too outcome-focused, and we've not been process-focused enough, if you will, so that we can find the critical points of success and the critical points of failure and fix the critical points of failure. So I think our process has not been right. I think another important issue, Jeff, is the fact that there are no standardized instruments to do assessments. And I'm sure you've certainly faced that, where you have your own assessment, and but we need some standardized assessments, and we need forms even. And we need to get those into a common database that everybody can share.
Well, sure.
It's silly that we can't do that.
Well, a couple questions here, follow-up. It seems to me unbelievable that people are fighting their own turf battles when they're encountering this kind of human misery. And the second question is, you say it's getting better, which indicates to me that somebody is maybe in charge. Could you take both those on, please?
Jeff, do you want to try that first?
Just a quick comment on why it seems to have been, why it has been so chaotic, as you said. I think we have to remember that generally when these coordination processes kick into action, generally with the United Nations taking the lead on, well, not taking the lead, the national government takes the lead, but we're looking at Haiti, a situation which is equivalent to a failed state like Liberia in the 80s or Somalia in the early 90s, and not because of violence or political violence, just because the entire government structure was completely, not completely, but largely destroyed or at least put on hold as, you know, people go to see if their family is all right, this sort of thing. The fact that it is coming together, I think, does say that probably the United Nations, with help from the U.S. government, the Clinton Initiative and others, are sitting down, and with Preval and others, are sitting down to try to hammer this process that in other countries would normally take place. In my experience, in Africa, in countries that are poorer than Haiti even, these processes do happen, but they happen, number one, because there is a national government, and number two, because the disasters aren't normally in the capital city wiping out the structure that would kick that process into action. So there are going to be wrinkles and ruptures until finally the right UN agencies, it's the Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, known as OCHA, or other agencies are given the word by the Secretary General to go ahead, sit down, and lead the coordination.
All right. Thank you very much for the call, Jeff. You were so informative. Let's move to Anne from Madison. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I wanted to talk about the role of the United States and the International Monetary Fund. The reason Haiti has virtually no government is that the U.S. and its corporate friends around the world escorted Father Aristide to South Africa, where, you know, he's forced to stay. They won't give him a passport to come back. He was the only person fighting globalization, which destroyed Haiti's infrastructure. It destroyed their small farmers. It handed over the country to corporate control, and whatever was done to exploit the Haitians was okay with these great big powers. And the BBC has reporters who've been on the ground in very isolated parts of Haiti and talking to people. And although in Port-au-Prince apparently things are somewhat better, they say there are people who haven't gotten any food or water, or, you know, nobody from any medical team has been there the whole 7 or 8 days. And the BBC reporter, I was thought it was especially, you know, interesting, described the U.S. Defense Department's attitudes toward relief as obsessed with security. And we've all heard that 5 French planes, I think operated by Médecins Sans Frontières, were denied entry into the airport so that more U.S. armed troops could get in. And you know, I just think there isn't any evidence of, except under extreme desperation, you know, near death, of any looting. And yet people who haven't had any food or water for all these days, who break into stores, are described as looters and people to be afraid of. So I really think we need to, you know, why can't the people just line up at the airport? If they can't get the trucks out, why can't people line up and at least be given food and water?
Dr. Birnbaum.
Yeah, I think there are several things here. One of them, again, is the lack of a plan, and I think a lack of establishing priorities. And so what you're talking about really bodes what are the priorities and who says that they're the priorities, and I think that has to be established. I think one of the things that we have to be very careful of here is the media and the media hype that tends to really drive many of the responses. And I think the responses have to be based on needs, not in terms of what the media sees as the needs. So that, I mean, the media can take a small episode, and blow it way out of perspective. And part of this is what's going on. In many of the other disasters of this magnitude, I think the media has been the primary driving force for many of the responses. And I think that's an issue of the media not understanding and looking for news. So my sense is we're not exactly sure about what happened to the aircraft for Médecins Sans Frontières and why they were diverted. But we need to find out the process by which that occurred, so that doesn't happen again, if, in fact, what they were providing was very important.
Mm-hmm. Ann, thank you very much. And I think Tom from Babcock also wanted to talk to the media about the media. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Yes, that was a good lead into my question. I'm just wondering about the role or the place of the media in these kinds of situations. You know, the tragedy occurs, and then within hours, Katie Couric, Brian Williams, and Anderson Cooper, all these people flood in. And I just can't imagine that that's helpful to the circumstances. There's such chaos around them to facilitate their movement and broadcasting and doing their work. And I'm wondering if that's beneficial, if it's a hindrance, and if there needs to be some caution, you know, put out for them.
Well, I think I said that I think there has to be great caution in this kind of response and sensationalism, if you will. That's very disturbing when things are going as well as they possibly can, given the circumstances. And I think the media can be of tremendous service in terms of informing people about what the needs are from their perception, but also attempt to use them to work with the community, affected community, and to help get the right information and the appropriate information. So I think the media ought to be taking their information primarily from the clusters, if you will, from the people that are in charge, and who understand what the needs are, rather than the hype produced by the media, because they're looking for stories. And we saw the same thing in the tsunami and the same thing in the Pakistan earthquake, etc. I mean, this happens over and over again. And I think we just have to use great caution in understanding the limited perspective often provided by the media. And I think that was also mentioned by Jeff, is that there are many, many logistical problems that are much bigger and much more important than rescuing one person out of the rubble who still is alive, who may not survive anyway. And what it does is it takes the priority for things like search and rescue way above what other things are needed.
Mm-hmm. And the other,
that's part of the perspective and part of not having a plan and good priorities.
On the other hand, the media has been responsible for getting people to give millions and millions and millions of dollars.
That's correct, and I absolutely agree with that, Kathleen. And I think that's one of the services they can do. But if you look what happened in following the tsunami, is that there was too much material, too much money. They're still not sure what to do with all of the money. But that's not a problem for the media. I'm saying the media can be very, very useful in mobilizing resources and appropriate resources. They are. And that's what's happening, I think, in terms of Haiti. There's millions of dollars coming forward now, hopefully for good purposes.
Right. Dr. Birnbaum, we'll be with you again in just a moment. Dr. Mervyn Birnbaum, our guest this part of the show, Emeritus Professor of Medicine and Physiology at UW-Madison and Vice President for Humanitarian Affairs for the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine. We'll take more phone calls in a moment as well. Tom, thanks for your call. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We return to phone calls. Ron from Madison is next. Hi, Ron.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah, I'm with the Madison Fire Department, and I know Dr. Birnbaum. We've worked closely together over the last several years in our careers, and I couldn't agree more with his statement about the organizational structure that's required to manage a disaster response. Prior to any disaster, communities, states, nations, et cetera, have to plan for these events, and there's incident management systems and training required to, and, you know, interagency agreements that all have to be in place to allow a response to occur smoothly and efficiently. Unfortunately, with Haiti, whether the planning had occurred or not, you've got the worst case where you've got the seat of government taken out. Without that authority on the ground, any responders coming in to set up a framework have to work under an authority having jurisdiction. And without that authority having jurisdiction there to allow an organized response to be set up and to be established, you see disjointed response, small efforts, you know, all the complaints that you're hearing about, ineffective resource delivery, et cetera, that's all part of that disjointed response without a structure being in place to allow these services to be applied. And Dr. Birnbaum's right. It's about the planning. It's about the agreements. It's about the regionalization. All of that has to be in place prior to anything ever happening in your community.
I'm still confused about this. So we've got a small national government still in Haiti, but we don't have a coordinated effort. So given the fact that we don't quite have that and something needs to be done now, who should be in charge? How does somebody become in charge, Dr. Birnbaum?
I think that goes back to the cluster movement and to regional structure. I think that if the country can't do it, then the region needs to do it. And there has to be an agreement that that's what will happen if, in fact, the government is knocked out. And so those kind of agreements have to be reached before the event. And I think Ron's right. I think there has to be a lot of planning and some preparedness. Now, there's a big issue, Kathleen, about preparedness, and that is if preparedness works, then nothing happens. And if nothing happens, it's very hard to get resources to enhance preparedness. Because on a political basis, in terms of getting resources, it becomes difficult when the politicians can't demonstrate that there's been some effect. And I could ask you, has NATO been effective? And there was no war. Does that mean that they were effective, and therefore will we get resources? One of the things that happened in Southeast Asia following the tsunami is that we had several meetings of all of the countries, of the ministries of all of the countries. And one of the things that they've now established is an emergency relief fund and a regional plan for Southeast Asia. The countries have all agreed to provide 1% of their budgets toward preparedness.
Mm.
And I think that's a good model for other parts of the world to use. We should have that kind of agreement in the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's the United States and Canada, Mexico, or Latin America and the Caribbean. I mean, that's where the guts have to be in countries that are downtrodden like this to begin with. And so I think there has to be a plan where there'll be a smooth transition of the responsibility from the national government when the national government says we can't do this anymore. And I know Ron has experienced this in transition of incident command from one level to a higher level when, in fact, that transition was needed. But it's planned ahead of time.
Ron, thank you so much for calling in today. And Dr. Birnbaum, thank you for your time. Much appreciated.
Very welcome.
Dr. Marvin Birnbaum, our guest this part of the show. He is at UW-Madison, professor of medicine and physiology, and also has been the president, is now the vice president for humanitarian affairs for the World Association for Disaster and Emergency Medicine, and he has written and studied extensively disasters in other parts of the world. Also, thanks to Dr. Hernando Garzon, who joined us earlier from Haiti, Kaiser Permanente emergency physician in Sacramento, team leader for Relief International in Haiti, Chip Duncan, a documentary filmmaker and author. If you go to his Facebook, he's been able to send a few pictures back from Haiti. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production.